Welcome to the Sanity Interview. My name is A.R. Hoffman, and every week, my co-host, Rebecca Sugar, and I talk to the people you want to hear from.
This week, we're joined by Admiral Jonathan Greenert. Welcome.
Welcome. Thank you very much. I appreciate it.
Admiral Greenert is a former four-star Navy admiral. He retired in 2015 after serving as chief of the Navy. His 40-year career included service in nuclear submarines, command of Navy fleets, and several positions in the Pentagon in financial management. He and his family have lived in Japan, Guam, Hawaii, the West Coast, and Washington, D.C. He graduated from the U.S. Naval Academy in 1975 with a degree in ocean engineering and subsequently studied nuclear engineering. Admiral Greenert was born and raised in western Pennsylvania. Admiral, I wanted to start with President Trump's address to Congress several weeks ago, in which he mentioned building ships in America. It was sort of just one line or two, but it caught my attention because I think I immediately realized that, at least in my imagination, modern warfare was almost entirely directed towards the skies. When I think about it, I think about drones and, F-15s or whatever they are. And
F-47s,
right. I might be behind. And the Space Force. And I think about maybe even UFOs. But all eyes sort of go upward when we think about modern warfare. And maybe I just missed the seas. I neglected to pay attention. And then I wondered if the entire country has been neglecting to pay attention to our capacity at sea, militarily and otherwise. So I think we should just start with your assessment of the Navy as it is today, our readiness for potential conflict, and where we should be. And if you could just help us understand that.
Sure. And thanks for the question, Rebecca. AR, it's a pleasure to meet you, and I'm very happy to be here today. I think this is a topic that is ripe for national debate or just understanding or conversation. And I say that because of the executive order that President Trump spoke to and now has put out on April the 9th, and I'll get to that. But to the essence of your question, you mentioned the Navy. The topic is broader than the Navy. It's all maritime. And you, like many other citizens, say, well, wait a minute. Well, if I'm talking warfare or anything like that, I look up. And that makes sense to me. I'll mention that. Think about the maritime aspect as shaping our world in ways that we want to, number one. Two, being sure that our global trade runs smoothly through all the areas of the world. And number three, deterrence, to deter our enemies so that we're not looking up and seeing aircraft going and, you know, and drones and everything else and satellites. So very quickly, I'll go back to the beginning of the Navy. This is the 250th year of the Navy. In October of this year, it'll be the 250th anniversary. George Washington, when he was the general, said, hey, the British are running into and around from anywhere from New York Harbor to all over the place. We have nothing to stop that. They're taking our trade. They are taking our sailors, our commercial seamen, and making them effectively Royal Navy slaves on their ships. We have to stop this. So he, a general, started a Navy by leasing ships, merchant, you know, people that say, oh, I'll do it, I'll protect you. And they started effectively harassing the Royal Navy. And this went to the point where, actually, in the defense of New York, part of the reason New York was not overrun by the Continental Army, for what that's worth, was because of the first Navy event, if you will, that took place, our Navy. And it was run by a guy named Benedict Arnold, who some may say, wait a minute, wasn't he the traitor? Well, later on he was. But at first, he was a general who got on ships with Army people who became guns people on ships and stopped the Continental Navy up in Lake Champlain and saved New York. Long diatribe about a small thing, but that's where it started. And why was the Navy started? Number one, protect our commerce. Number two, protect the United States. So why do we have a Navy today? Number one, protect the United States. Number two, protect American citizens. And number three, obviously protect U.S. trade. But in order to protect U.S. trade, we have to sort of protect or enable global trade, because globalization may be shrinking, but we are who we are today, globally, pretty rich compared to who we used to be globally, much less poverty, much less illiteracy, all the good things that took place because of a lot of trade that took place mostly since World War II. So what is the point here? Well, the mission is pretty much the same. It does, most of the time, the Navy, our Navy is spent protecting the sea lanes. Yeah, and that's why this Houthi thing is sort of interesting in the Red Sea, because this is the first time in 70 years that the sea lanes have been challenged, because we collectively have been able to do that. So our Navy grew after World War II, the last time we really had serious at-sea fighting, we're all familiar with that, to become really the deterrent from pirates, from smugglers, and from any other potential adversary from attacking us, attacking U.S. citizens, and interrupting global trade. So where are we today? And I'll finish with this. We have the best Navy in the world today. We really do. The problem is the Navy is a capital-intensive entity. You can grow an army fairly quickly. You can encourage more people to join the army, pay more money, you know, make it a thing that is of great attraction. And we have done that. We've grown the Army and the Marine Corps up to 10-15% in a matter of 4, 5, 6 years. But the Navy, it takes 4, 5 years, 6 years, 8 years to build a ship. Very capital intensive. And so is the Air Force. To build the, you mentioned F-15s, the F-47, we announced it. It's going to be a long time before we see the first airplane, 6, 8 years. So these things they're capital intensive. But, and so therefore we are behind, woefully behind in where we want to be at building a Navy. And let's get to President Trump's executive order, building a maritime fleet. And that includes commercial, because we don't have a maritime fleet. We don't build any commercial ships to speak of. For context, last factoid, in the world we live in today, we, the United States, build 1% of the global world shipping commercial. China builds 75%. So we build not even 1 out of 10, you know, not even 1 out of 100. They build 75 out of 100. Pretty crazy. Yeah. So that's what that's about.
I so appreciate you, Admiral, starting with the history, because I think a lot of Americans understand that the Navy is sort of integral to America's sense of itself. I think you're absolutely right to say that Americans also understand that it's at the intersection of national security and kind of global trade. And so when you look at kind of maybe the two main theaters, naval or maritime theaters now, on the one hand, the Red Sea, and on the other hand, the South China Sea, maybe you can take us into each one of those theaters and see what are you seeing, what are the challenges, and what are the opportunities?
Yeah, that's a good point, AR, because our Navy's mission in the South China Sea versus the Middle East, the Mediterranean or the Red Sea, are kind of the same, but the end state is different. And here's, I'll explain. So let me start with the Middle East. The Middle East is a relatively constrained area, water-wise, certainly compared to the Western Pacific, with miles and miles, thousands of miles of water. But here's the mission in the Middle East. The Navy provides forces that can be to deter Iran, Houthi, other proxies from, say, Iran, or other missions as required. They provided support in Syria. They provided for U.S. forces support in Iraq when that was there and in Afghanistan. And we work with Israel in this regard, our primary ally there. So what is the mission? It's really to take forces or the threat of forces from at sea ashore. It's not a naval battle. The U.S. Navy is really not, there's no competitor out there to speak of, no conflict at sea. But so therefore, it is deterrence, the threat of force from the sea and or the application therein. And therefore, you need your presence alone as a deterrent, but of course, it can be used quickly. And that's the mission. Now, the size of the Navy is such that we never really anticipated doing that, didn't expect it. We thought, well, this will be land business, and we'll have some bases and reasonable allies on land, if you will, in sovereign territories, Bahrain, Israel was as needed, Turkey, a member of NATO, et cetera. But we have reduced that presence a great deal on purpose. The nation said, no, we don't think we should need that, but it subsequently turned out we did. Therefore, we turned to the Navy. So it's a mission the Navy didn't anticipate to be as great as it is. Let me go to the South China Sea. Well, the presence of the Navy in the South China Sea is to deter China from, say, taking Taiwan or other things, to deter North Korea from attacking South Korea, and then to a lesser extent, other, let's say, malcontents out there in the Asia-Pacific region. But we are directly confronting China in the South China Sea. We steam in and around each other, kind of show the force, show our exercise capability, and some might say flex your muscles, but that's a reasonable term for that because it's about deterrence. Working with allies, very important, Australia, Japan, South Korea, and sometimes India. And so we are confronting a potential adversary at sea. We are threatened, if you will, at sea, different from the Middle East. Our mission in the Asia Pacific and the South China Sea is not to really deliver force ashore, but to show in an international medium, the South China Sea and the broader Western Pacific, that this freedom of navigation, there's trillions and trillions of dollars of global trade goes through the South China Sea to ensure that it stays open, number one, ensure China is not bullying its neighbors, including Taiwan, the Philippines, and that those seas, those international waterways, stay open.
Admiral, I want to take you now over to another part of the world, Panama. Secretary Hegseth announced not too long ago an agreement with Panama to reinstate U.S. forces in Panama and also to give priority passage to U.S. naval ships through the canal. Can you just talk about that agreement? How important do you think it is strategically, and how much is that going to affect China's dominance in the region?
Yeah, that's a good question, Rebecca. I'm glad you asked it because I had to smile when I saw the rhetoric, you know, we're taking back the Panama Canal. Well, that's really not true. The agreement doesn't really do that. On the other hand, it's not insignificant. And here's what I mean by that. Part of the Panama Agreement, when we turned it over a long time ago, was that we would be there and available to assure its security. And that was supposed to be a good deal for Panama so that they weren't bullied around, since they were now going to be, if you will, the purveyors of the Panama Canal, just as Egypt does the same thing for the Suez Canal. And Egypt takes that very seriously. They make a lot of money from it. Panama takes it very seriously. And so this kind of long-term evolving threat of China in all of Central America, and particularly in Panama, which is so important because of the Panama Canal, it just wasn't viewed to be a big deal in the primary interest of the United States until this administration. And seeing this evolution of China kind of infiltrating, for lack of a better term, both commercially, diplomatically, and then in real presence there, not necessarily military, but you get my point, they're there on both ends. They said, okay, enough. So think of it as a refreshing and sort of a little bit of building up the agreement in place. Number one, we will assure the security of the Panama Canal. We made that very clear. Number two, I'll tell you what we'll do, Panama. Let's increase our exercising. We're going to make sure that you, who are responsible for the security of the canal, know what you're doing, your military. And so we'll upgrade your tactics, your techniques, your procedures. We'll provide you some physical support as necessary. Number three, you're all aware, our business element said, okay, look, we shouldn't have them, China, owning the key areas at the entrance and exit of the canal in that those various areas. We need to buy that and make sure we have the economic control of it. And then lastly, we said, look, if needed, we need some, think of them as places, not bases. A base is literally a kind of a sovereign piece of land that country would have its forces in. We don't want that necessarily. They didn't offer it. They don't want it. And so we're not going there yet. But as needed, like some of our NATO friends and others, if there is a threat, they have the landing fields. They have the means for us to stage forces should there be a threat at that level. So it's very important. I think it was needed. It's a good signal to show that we're paying attention there when we've kind of been away from that. And let's face it, it's a prime waterway.
Yeah. I wonder, you know, as we talk more about trade wars and real wars, if, you know, those two dual missions of the Navy of protecting trade and you know, acting militarily are set to converge. I also am struck by Vice President Vance's comments the other day, sort of imagining an alternative future for the Suez Canal or an alternative past. It's sort of striking how these bodies of water that maybe were at the back of the consciousness of Americans for a long time have sort of re-entered it. Let me ask you, Admiral, we had an editorial last month about the sinking of the USS Constitution, an intentional sinking as the ship was out of commission, I guess you'd say. You mentioned capital issues. I think a lot of Americans have this idea of we need to build more ships. Is it a resource allocation question? Is it an expertise question? Is it a political will? Or actually, are we doing okay? And finally, is it an insecurity born of China's productivity? Is that really where this is coming from? Is their ability to produce things on a massive scale?
Good summary, AR, because it's all of the above, and I'll try to clarify. So if you go back to the end of World War II, and think of this as the broader maritime, the building of Navy ships, warships. Think of it as building like ammo ships, supply ships, oilers, you know, to fuel. And so they'd be support at hospital ships, building those. And then there's commercial ships like container ships, et cetera. We had it all. And some would say, some historians say, let me tell you how we won World War II. It was our industrial base. Man, we mobilized the industrial base and it blew everybody away. It resourced Russia and Europe, and they are the ones that really defeated the Germans. And then, of course, that's how we won in the Western Pacific. Okay, so now World War II is over. We have tremendous debt. We have a huge unemployment problem. We have a military-industrial base that is enormous, and we need to get post-war. So we made a couple of conscious decisions. Number one, we said we can never allow our aerospace industry writ large to decay, or if you will, become other than the world's leading. That gets back to Rebecca, one of your very early statements was, well, man, every time I think of, you know, deterrence and warfare, I look to the sky. So we declared aerospace would be number one, and we would be the government. So the government has always subsidized aerospace purposely. Number two, we had a great maritime industry, and we said, well, we'll let this take its course in accordance with economic needs. So as World War II ends, we had such an enormous maritime industry, it was doing fine. Somewhere around the Reagan administration era, 1980, we said the Cold War is over. Why do we need such an enormous Navy? We had about 600 ships. Why are we spending all this money, federal money, on our maritime industry, subsidizing it? We're going to stop doing that. So it started with Reagan. Again, the aerospace lobby, very powerful, said, well, not us. So you're going to sustain us. And the federal government said yes, and they always have. And they've done a good job. That's why the space program and all those things. By the way, SpaceX, heavily subsidized by the federal government early on. So we allowed that to just decay because purposely we said, well, how are we going to keep trade up? Because over 90% of our trade and the world's trade by volume goes by sea. They said, well, we'll lease ships. I mean, China's built a whole bunch of ships. So is Korea. So is Japan. We have a good relationship. They're willing to produce them. They have cheap labor. Their inflation rates are low for the materials that make ships. And we had no desire or need to build a large fleet. You go to today, and I already mentioned a couple anecdotes of the size of the maritime fleet in general. So today we've said, hey, look, this competition with China is across the board. It's diplomatically, militarily, it's economically, and then all parts of the economy, including maritime. 3 out of 4 ships, commercial, are built in China. The rest, pretty much, are built in Korea and Japan. So we said, today we're saying, you know, we shouldn't be so dependent on China maritime-wise because it is so important to our economy, and it became kind of a wake-up call. We need to infuse some development into our maritime industry, therefore the economic order. So to answer your AR, you mentioned a lot of things. You said, well, do we have the wherewithal? No, not today. Did we spend the money? No, not today. Do we have the need? Well, not till recently that we felt we needed to do. Do we have the will? We're going to see. But we certainly seem to see the need. And my last little piece on this is China recently, as part of this tit for tat, you know, and the tariffs, they said, hey, we're not shipping any more of this kind of material category to the United States on Chinese ships. So that's a little anecdote. That caught my eye in the paper. I said, I don't know where this could go, but that's a lot of shipping.
Admiral, the future of everything feels like AI, right? That seems to be the answer to everything. What's the future of AI and technology in terms of autonomous ships and commercial and military grade? And, and what do you think about the use of AI in our military in particular? I think that sort of national security questions come up there. Can you just give us your sense of where that's headed?
If I could just jump in, you know, we had, a very good question from one of our readers and listeners is that who does disruptive technology benefit? Does it benefit the established powers or does it benefit up and coming powers? So the role of AI and kind of who wins, who is poised to take advantage of it?
Well, I think a big answer to that question, AR, is look at Ukraine and look what they've done with drones. I mean, when Russia invaded Ukraine, started that invasion, there might have been a handful, probably 10 or less, of companies in Ukraine that build or have anything to do with drones. There's 500 of them today. They build drones that are in the hundreds of dollars for purchase. I mean, it's kind of enough said that. So I think that is an anecdote of the answer to your question as to who it benefits the most. Relatively speaking, it benefits the developing or the lesser developed countries more than the already developed countries. But on the other hand, the developed countries, China, you know, just pick the top 10 economies, you'd say vastly improve your productivity and everything that there is about it. AI is a part of the military. Right now, what it does perhaps more than anything else is reduces the burden on personal interface on the gathering of information. Information is sorted through to determine, is any of this gobs and gobs, big data coming into us, how much of it is really intelligence? That is useful for what we do, if you will, militarily. And then of the intelligence, how much of that is useful to either do an attack or not do an attack or move your forces here or keep your people safe or threaten and then use for deterrence a potential adversary. So just being able to quickly, and I emphasize that, gather the data, determine what data is useful, how much of it is intelligence, and then how much would you use tactically, and then get that out to that F-15, F-47, whatever you want to try something. So that unto itself provides the advantage for you versus any adversary, just the assimilation of big data. Then, of course, there's the autonomous vehicles, air, sea, above the sea and under the sea, that provides you a vast network of intelligence gatherers that bring this data gatherers that bring this back and that you assimilate all that data together. Whoever has that information dominance is probably going to be the victor. And therefore, the competition for AI is very important militarily. Using that like an autonomous vehicle or thing to launch a missile or do something kinetic. Now you're passing a threshold, which is very unique to a democracy that is very much ruled by the rule of law and things of that. So that is a big legal hurdle we need to get over at some point. So for now, think of it as a hybrid capability.
Let me ask you just specifically about Taiwan. I spent a week there last summer, and you're very aware that this is an island in the shadow of a very large mainland.
They're very aware of that.
Clearly naval capacity or capability is going to be at the center of whatever happens there, whether there is war or isn't war. How do you assess the situation? Mainland China has been more aggressive of late. What are our capacities there? What is our will there? And what are some possible scenarios you see unfolding?
So I'll start with the last point you made or question you made and hopefully develop it. The possibilities are sort of a cyber, think of it as a strangulation, suffocation through cyber and social media, if you will, a cultural, social control, embedded cells within Taiwanese society. And they're all over the United States, by the way. I could give examples of that and what I mean, just the results they're in. And think of it that such that Taiwan eventually comes to the conclusion through their citizens that said, these folks aren't so bad. We really ought to look at this as something that is inevitable. We are, in fact, kind of cousins, partners, whatever. And if you go back in history, we were very close. Let's do it. You know, let's annex. And some would say, well, the desire for freedom overwhelmed that. Well, I don't know, but that would be one scenario. Another scenario would be suffocation through economic means. Think of it as a blockade, because it is an island, to your point. And then there's the over, just flat out kinetic, an invasion. And those are the big scenarios. Likelihood, I don't know. But make no mistake, China is gone beyond building up the capability from invasion through all those other things I said to flat out rehearsal. And the commander of the Pacific Command, in the spring, each of the, we call them combatant commanders, the various people that command the forces, U.S. forces around the world, they come into Congress and do a testimony. And it's usually in April. And the commander of the Pacific Command, his name was Paparo, he just recently testified. And it really caught my eye, the highlights, when he describes how China is not preparing as much now as they are rehearsing what they are going to do. And it is a matter not that can they do it, is if will they find the, you know, that opportunity or something that triggers internally, and are we able to deter that and make sure we have that signal clear to Xi Jinping that for you to attempt to do this or to do this, the cost is too high. And he gives a lot of anecdotes about what that cost would be in gross domestic product, unemployment in Asia and the world, and in the potential for casualties and what it might be. So it's a vast spectrum of possibilities. But the thing is, AR, we are getting, we should be very nervous about where we are right now. I mean, very nervous.
Admiral, just to, maybe this would be our last question to close it out, but I wondered, you didn't sound very committed earlier when we talked about the EO and this administration's commitment politically, maybe the political will to actually rebuild our maritime capacity across the board. I just wanted to push you on that a little bit and get a more firm answer to that. Do you feel hopeful that we are going to get back to the levels that you would deem appropriate for our maritime fleet? And do you think that would come from government funding or perhaps the Anduril's of the world and a sort of SpaceX of the seas kind of company and that kind of investment?
Yeah, thanks for pushing me on that, Rebecca. I think that it's appropriate. I'll comment on. First of all, since the Reagan administration, no administration, it has to start at the White House, in my view, has said, hey, well, we need a reset of our maritime capacity in general, our entire enterprise, Navy shipbuilding and commercial shipbuilding, until now. And so to be clear, this executive order, in essence, does one thing. Give me an action plan. I want it by November of this year, which describes all the various things you, and he really tasks it out from the Department of Transportation through the U.S. Trade Representative, Department of Defense, really all the cabinet members, coordinated by the White House to say, tell me what it'll cost. Tell me what we should do now and through the years. What resources are out there to get this thing kickstarted? And I want it to be, we, the federal government, going back to what they did for the aerospace industry, I want to subsidize it and then make it easy for investment. It would make sense for this president and the way he thinks that this would be a big business thing. And that's exactly the essence and what will get us out of this. Private equity firms, Anduril's, Palantir's, and a whole host of them that would say, well, let me tell you how we can build ships more quickly, better, and maybe, you know, for a longer legacy of shipbuilding. We don't want to, our goal would never to be to, well, we're going to build ships like China does. We don't need that. We just need enough to make us feel like we have enough. And we can still lease and flag ships by getting them from Korea or Japan for allies. But we really don't have any industry, and we need to get it up on its feet to the degree that we can. So to answer your question, yes, Rebecca, we can do that. It will take will. It'll have to transcend administrations, and it will take a real focused effort by not only the government, but a decision among industry and finance to say, this is a good investment, and this will bring me returns.
Great. I think we'll get Anduril on next time, and they can talk about their plans. Yeah. Really appreciate your
Admiral,
time
thank
today.
Thank you so much.
Thank you.
You're welcome.
Take care. Bye-bye.